Welcome to Talking Story. I'm your host, Lynn Hadley. Talking Story is an interview program meant to excavate the original gems of stories and experiences from people in our community. And today, our guest is Derek Moore, known to many as owner-director of the 1015 Theater, and for the past 10 years, he is the creative genius behind Derek Moore Building Arts, whose wide-ranging projects include contracting, furniture building, and design and remodeling, from tree houses to fine furniture and sculpture, and founding member of upbeat rock and roll band Midas Digs. I could go on and on, but we already have insufficient time to cover the many talents of this actively artistic and accomplished Renaissance man. Welcome, Derek Moore.
Jeez, thank you. Yeah, I love it.
Oh,
thanks, Lynn.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Let's start with what took you to Scotland and the Rudolf Steiner School of Camp Hill, a community of folks with special needs.
Yeah, well, I would say that's kind of where my whole artistic life began, really. Got out of college, got married right out of college, and my ex-wife, my wife at the time, we decided we wanted to go volunteer somewhere before we sort of settled down into life, and just looked for a place anywhere in the world we could go do something, and found this place called Camp Hill Rudolf Steiner Schools for people with special needs. And it's a place where you live and work together with the people who you're looking after. And everybody there is volunteer from all over the world. And it's an extremely artistic place because the jobs that we had the students working on were primarily artistically bent. So we had candle making, we had woodwork shop, we had weaving, we had estate work, gardening work, the beautiful garden. I mean, it was, so this is what we did every day with the students, and then we'd have lunch and dinner and look after them, and it was a really profound, all-inclusive experience. And what I did there was the woodwork shop. I didn't really have much experience in that, other than helping my uncle do a few things, who was a carpenter. And so there's where I learned the kind of the basics of how to work with wood, but also to be really patient, because in working with like autistic kids, you have to have a lot of patience. Yes. So developing those skills in that way, in that situation, was very profound. I was there for a year, came back home, loved it so much, went back again for another year and a half, and then life circumstances brought me back home. And then another 7 months I went back, for almost another year. And then, so I just kept doing this. A lot of my young life was bouncing back and forth between here and there, always trying to explore some sort of artistic angle in how to make a living in a way that I loved. Every time I was here in Oregon, I was doing something that wasn't filling my soul, and then I would go back there and have a great time, but it was extremely stressful and extremely difficult, because we worked basically 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. every day, 6 days a week. We only had one day off, so
wow,
it was very exhausting.
And David Newbat,
mm-hmm.
He was a great influence on that soul-filling?
Yeah, he was the house father, so he and his wife ran the place where we lived, Stephanie Newbat, and he was a painter, woodworker. He was one of these people who just did everything, and he never thought about it. If there was something to do, he just did it. He was a director of plays. He set up the lighting for it. He'd build sets. He'd paint. He was asked to go all over the world and paint things. So he was like one of these people that just amazed me, and he absolutely did it with no ego whatsoever. Just like, this is just what you do. You just create things.
and approach life with the world as an empty canvas to be filled kind of thing.
Something that I've struggled to do most of my life, he could do with the greatest of ease, which was like, you see a problem, it's not a problem at all, it's an opportunity. You see something that needs doing. How could we, let's do this. And then his first thought is, how could we do that in an interesting way? And that was, to me, the greatest lesson. I mean, I had 4 years in college, and the first year of Camp Hill, I felt eclipsed all my education beyond that, just in how to view the world in a way different from than I naturally did, which was, I got to overcome problems and
burdened.
I'm still not super good at it. I've been working on it for a long time. He had it naturally, just absolutely could do it with the greatest of ease.
Wow. It is a very common human struggle, though, is it not?
Yeah. Yeah. And some people just look at it very light and very, I mean, he just liked to do everything. He just liked to do stuff. I realized at some point in my life, I did too. I like to do it, but I had to find a different source for doing it. Because it didn't come as naturally. So I do it more for the feeling that I'm doing something worthwhile with my hands.
The creative construction of it all?
Yeah, yeah. The process of creating something makes me feel happy. So that's what I'm aiming for. I'm not trying to solve a problem. I'm trying to experience something along the way. And I had to just find my own bent in how to do it, because he was dealing with a massive community of people, all who needed organizing and jobs. And I mean, he was like a manager type of mind. And I am not that mind at all. I just want to put my mind to the job at hand and let someone else deal with the managerial side of it. So for him, it was getting through, figuring out how to make everything work, and he could just plop, 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 plop. And for me, it's like one task at a time.
And that took you to your building arts business?
Yeah. So I eventually, down the line, after I had tried a few other jobs, when I came back, I moved to the coast in 2003, actually moved to Manzanita, and needed a job. I actually was working at the Warrenton Middle School with the special needs program, but only for 3 weeks because I wasn't very happy in that particular situation. And so I quit my job and had nothing to do. I had no work. Living on the coast, no promising forward movement that I could see. And I met a guy whose advice to me was, just go find a work site and ask if they need some help. I thought, what? That's way too easy. He said, just try it. And I did. I found a construction site, and I walked up to the carpenter there, and I said, do you guys need any help? And he said, how much experience do you have? And I said, not very much. I built some benches. And then he said, well, my lead carpenter quit yesterday, so you can start tomorrow for $8 an hour. And I was like, all right. And then in 1 year, he basically taught me how to build. He and I built a 3,500 square foot house, almost the two of us alone. And I learned everything, the basis of everything I needed to know. And then I started my own business at the end of that first year because I was like, I can do this on my own. Mainly because I hate having a boss. I just do not like it.
It's easier to not contain that creative spirit when you have your own palette to work on.
That's it. And so therefore, I started building benches because I had done that in Scotland. So I would find driftwood on the beach because I lived in Manzanita, about 5 minutes walk from the beach, and would carve it, shape it, take all the weathering out of it, and then build, I called it artistic furniture. Funky furniture is the word I used. And I did pretty good. I probably made and sold about 60 or 70 benches for about a year and a half, and then moved to Astoria.
So in working, what's your process in working with a particular medium like driftwood? Does it,
yeah.
Does it speak to you immediately as to this is what it was meant to be, or is it
sometimes
the line through it that just captures you?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, in the case of driftwood, you can on the beach as you see it, you can get a sense of like, oh, this would be cool for such and such. Sometimes, but more often than not, I would just pile stuff up in my garage, and when I was building something, I just go through my stuff and just literally hold stuff up. Does that fit? Does that work? Oh, those look good together. But then you carve it and you take all the gray off of it and you shape it to something that you didn't see on the beach. You know, so I liked taking off the weathering and seeing the wood underneath and all the burl and various things you discover. I haven't made a bench in probably 7 or 8 years. It's been a long, so I sort of moved out of that into more building and remodeling and kind of being known as somebody who would take on unusual projects, something that wasn't just regular remodeling, but like I want a really fancy shelf, you know, or I want a staircase that has some funky elements to it or something like that. And of course I do others. Most of what I do, honestly, is just straight up remodeling or building outside structures like decks and sheds and things like that. But,
oh, and I want to let people know that you, they can see examples of your work at, is it www.derekmoore.com?
Yeah.
There's a sampling of your interesting creations.
Try and put a lot of the funky stuff I've done on that. Yeah. I haven't updated that in a little while. it's a little on the older side, but that's all stuff I've done. Yeah.
And then I guess your next undertaking or that you were able to direct that toward your dramatic arts in processing that into what has become was initially Peer Pressure Productions,
yep,
that at the end of last year became 1015
Theater. Yep.
What all did it take to create that black box theater space?
A lot.
You can't see it here, but on the radio,
I'll
he just fell to his knees.
a quick backdrop. I hadn't acted since I was in Camp Hill, and I never acted in high school or anything like that. But in 2013, I did a show here called Hitchin that Ned Heavenrich wrote, and when you do a show here, you often, the theater community says, oh, there's somebody who can act. Well, let's involve them. So I started acting and I loved it. And people would always talk about the River Theater and how great it was that was here for a long time. And then the first Peer Pressure Productions, which Susie Brown had started and ran for a year in 2010 and 11, and there was very little outlet for that. You could do a show at the Pack, maybe, but there were things to work around. You'd often have to tear the set down for, you know, after each weekend. Astor Street occasionally had stuff that wasn't Shanghaied, and that was occasionally there, but there was no place that was dedicated to theater all the time, like the Coaster in Cannon Beach or something, you know. And Susie was hungry for that again. And she had talked about this space that opened up in the Oddfellows building. But it was just empty. It was a big empty space. She couldn't see how it could become a theater. But me as a builder, I could walk in and imagine it. And so she wanted to get my input. And long story short, we decided to work on it together. So what did it take? It took, at this point, somewhere in the area of about 1,200 hours
My.
Of work. Lots of money from Susie and I for materials and the whole process of setting everything up, permits, governmental stuff. It's endless. The list is endless. It was huge. It was an absolutely huge project. A real bucket list of mine, though, to transform a space into some performing arts. That's what I wanted since the first time I came to Astoria.
So again, pursuing a magnificent, creative, constructive outlet that fills your soul.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it did not fill my bank account.
Sometimes they don't match up.
They don't a lot. And every artist in this town, most of them will tell you that you do your art because you love it. You need to do it. It doesn't necessarily pay the bills.
Right.
So I've tried to make my work life interesting enough, the work that pays the bills interesting enough that I'm satisfied with it. And I think I've succeeded with that. Taking on the theater was a bit risky because I knew I wasn't going to get money back for it. But it was just something I loved. And I really wanted to see a theater. And I just kind of went on trust that once you build it, it will sustain itself.
Did Kevin Costner tell you that?
Yeah, actually, come on. I loved Field of Dreams when that came out. Yeah, if you build it, he will come. So yeah, it's been a long process, but now we've hit a strange curve because as we know, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to remind everyone they're listening to Talking Story on Coast Community Radio, and our guest today is Derek Moore. Now back to you, Mr. Moore.
Oh, well, we hit this curveball with the COVID-19 shutdown. We had prepared this whole show. The production takes quite a long time, eight weeks for everything. A fair amount of money is put into it. Beautiful set. Everything was ready to go. We were able to do opening night last Friday, and then made the decision to close basically the night before the governor dropped the limit from 250 down to 25. So we would have had to close anyway.
I was very fortunate to be in the audience for that opening night. And you performed music, Irish, was it Celtic music, you'd call it?
Yep.
And before the production, and it was very nicely done.
Thank you. And lots of people put time and effort into that show, and we are still hoping to do it. I hope that the cast is willing and able to come back to it when we can open up the theater again, because we put not just all the money into it, but we put a huge amount of time and effort. It takes a lot of time to learn lines and to block. And the director, Karen Bain, put a huge amount of effort into that over many, many, many months.
And this is The Weir, right?
The Weir.
And who's the playwright on that?
Connor McPherson, okay. The Irish playwright. It was voted one of the 100 best plays of the 20th century.
Wow.
Yeah. So we were like, well, this should be good. It's an Irish play. It's basically storytelling, but it's really fun. I mean, you saw it, so you have a sense of it's not lighthearted because it's kind of dark and deep with like ghost story sort of stuff, but it's really the Irish tone of it lifts you up.
What drives you to, because I've done some theater myself. It's extremely nerve-wracking. You've got to remember lines. You don't want anything to do with the stage the minute you have to go on to it. What about that performance art that is inspiring to you?
The fun of performing. So performance for various individuals is something akin to a drug trip. The experience of knowing that you're in absolutely focused in the moment, that you cannot veer your attention onto anything else other than what you're doing, because you know if you drop something, if you miss something, you're being watched. I think it's one of the few times that I get to experience pure present moment. And the present moment is extremely powerful if we focus on it. We're not thinking about the past or the future or what ifs, or you're absolutely there, and performance forces you into that. And that's why I personally love it. And I think most actors get some kind of rush, some kind of satisfaction out of that. I mean, there are certain people who just are absolutely comfortable in front of a crowd and don't get nervous at all, but I think they're somewhat rare.
Yes. I find that everybody in their underwear doesn't work for me at all.
Yeah. there are people who manage to do shows with severe stage fright, and they just work through it. And I imagine for them, that is even more of an accomplishment because it is nerve-wracking. I still get nervous. I was nervous for the opening of this show, and I wasn't even in it, besides the music at the beginning. But you just want things to go well, and you want to put on a good show. And, you know,
it's great exposure. I mean, you are playing a character, but you're not so much when it comes to music performance, especially you do a lot of songwriting. So yeah. You're really putting yourself on display.
That's right.
I have to ask, where does Midas Digs, the name of your band, what's the story there?
My name, Darick, is spelled D-A-R-I-C. It's an unusual spelling, and a Darick is a gold coin. It was the first historically written down monetary that came from the Emperor Darius, apparently from the Persian Empire and something BC. And so at some point, I can't remember exactly when, a boss of mine said something to the effect of, "Oh, you have the Midas touch," because whatever I was doing at that particular time was going well, you know, which doesn't always happen, but occasionally it does. And I kind of remembered that, you know, for when times are tough and you kind of lean on, like, just keep going, keep digging, keep looking for that spark that's in you.
Ooh.
So that's where the name came from, Midas Digs. You're basically digging for the nuggets that you know are within you, but you just can't see them because you feel cruddy, you know, or whatever. So
that's way better than Iron Maiden.
Well, I've never asked them where they got their name from. But I made the name up before I found the band, so I have to say that the band didn't, I don't know if they liked the name or not. They just joined the band. The name was already there. I hope they like it, but yeah, that's where it came from anyway.
But I noticed specifically on the band's website, you talk about discovery from like a place of sort of really being worn down and almost out of darkness, Phoenix like,
yep.
Perhaps.
Yeah. I think many artists will tell you that they get inspiration from being forced into it, meaning you're dealing with something in your life that is extremely difficult and you don't want it. You want to run from it, and you just live through it. And somehow or other, you come out the other end if you're lucky. But what you come out with is hopefully something that you've gained, some character building or something. Or in the case of the album, I needed to express emotions, and I wasn't terribly good at that from a direct standpoint, so I put it into the songs I was writing. I needed to write the songs purely to deal with the darkness. It was basically therapy. So, I've been trying to write songs since I was 18, and most of them were awful. And until I needed to do it out of necessity, I felt like they weren't very good. And these ones I felt were something else. They came from somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
So that's the point.
Cracked open
that.
A different space.
Yeah. And that's why I do any artistic endeavor, is to explore those spaces? Where are the spaces that aren't obvious? You have to find them by doing something that takes time and effort, and you may not get a reward from it, but you do it for some other reason, and that reason is some sort of discovery, some sort of satisfaction, some sort of evolving of your sense of self. I don't know. So that's why I explore lots of different art forms, is for that reason, is purely the need. When you're born a seeker, you don't have a choice. You just have to continue to seek. Otherwise, you just might as well end it all. And so it's an imperative.
When did you discover you were on your journey as a seeker?
Right around, I would say 20, 21.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fortunate.
Yeah. I felt like it was. I mean, I'd had a pretty easy childhood, so I didn't have a lot of struggle in my childhood. And I discovered in college that things were tough. And then a number of things happened, but that were life-changing and like, oh no, I'm not going to be one of those people that knows what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to discover it and make it up continually. And I was sometimes jealous of people who knew, this is what I want to do and I'm doing it. I'm like, how do you know that? How do you know? I don't get it. Well, all my life I've been
it's almost blissful ignorance. It's like,
depends on how you experience it, I guess.
No, I'm not saying what you do, but to kind of blindly, or I should stop making it like, you know, you're not knowing fully what you're doing. I don't mean to imply that, but to just sort of set a track and not be willing to change it, it seems like you're missing out on other paths.
Oh, you know, the way I look at that is everybody's got their own path. So if that's what makes them tick, then that's perfect for them. I'm just talking about knowing yourself is the most important thing. So you got to figure out what makes you tick. And I figured that out around in my early 20s. And finding out what makes me tick was not my career. In other words, I wasn't going to have one straight career. And that was nerve-wracking and has been nerve-wracking ever since. But I can't not do it. I just have to. It's just what makes me tick. And someone else, that's why I say I was jealous sometimes of people, because they figured out what makes them tick is to do this thing and do it well. Like, that sometimes feels like it'd be so much easier.
Well, gosh, as always, the time flies so quickly when I'm talking to these amazing and wonderful folks in our community. And I really am grateful to have you here today, Derek.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Lynn. And thanks for, you did all your homework getting on websites and looking up info. And that's really nice. Thank you. This has been really fun for me.
Well, thank you. And thanks for joining us here on Talking Story. It's been a pleasure to distract you.
Thanks, everyone.